housed on the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity every week to read, mark, learn, and take to heart the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, director of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, your host and fellow learner, Dr. John Oberdeck, professor of theology and coordinator for lay studies here at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Now, we have been going through the book of Exodus. Exodus has informed us about many important things concerning God's promises, particularly as he fulfills them through his chosen people, as they're guided by Moses out of the land of Egypt and then into the wilderness, where they do run into some difficulties. But before they do that, they then are given the Ten Commandments, and then they're taught how to worship. And that's really where we're picking up the discussion today, isn't it?
Very, very interesting part. There's a lot of detail here which we will not go into, but much of what occurs here is significant because, if you will recall, I think we mentioned last time that Moses was told to construct this tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant according to the pattern which God had showed him when Moses was on the mount. To review a little bit, Moses had gone up on that mount after he had taken the blood and sprinkled, now not only the people, but the writer of the Hebrews says in chapter 9, also the book which he had written in response to the message which God had given him. So that blood becomes very significant, and let me just focus on that idea for a moment. There are a lot of people today who do not like, quotes, a blood religion. But it was essential. It was a central feature of the worship practices here in the Old Testament. And maybe some of our listeners remember this verse, Abel's blood for vengeance pleadeth to the skies, but the blood of Jesus for our pardon cries, and that blood is signified or represented here in these sacrifices, and the blood which would, of course, be sprinkled and poured out. J.T. Mueller, I don't know if any of our listeners knows who he is or was, but he's sort of compiled Piper's Dogmatics into a single volume. And he has an interesting idea in which he presents this whole thing, but the blood of Jesus for our pardon cries. And that blood is crying, he says, grace, grace, forgiveness, forgiveness, indulgence, indulgence, Father, Father. And secures for us divine grace, forgiveness of sins, righteousness, and salvation. That's how important the idea presented here in the blood is. So, not to sort of minimize the importance of it. We'll go into that in a moment as we talk also about the location, because this was central in the lives of the Israelites. We mentioned the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. That was the central point of their lives, really. This is where they went for the forgiveness of sins. The atonement for sin was here. And the whole idea is in the fact that the priest would take the blood and go in, and on the Day of Atonement he would go in into the inner sanctum, if you will, the Holy of Holies, and then sprinkle that blood, first for himself and his family, and then, of course, for the people, securing again divine forgiveness, grace, and eternal salvation. All of that was focused here so that we have, for instance, just one illustration. We have Daniel, who was a very pious man. He had been carried into captivity, but while he was in captivity, he would look toward Jerusalem when he prayed. And in 1 Kings chapter 8, this is Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple, he made this statement, something to this effect. When heaven is shut up and there is no rain, for they have sinned against you, if they look toward this place and pray toward this place, hear thou in heaven and forgive their sins, the sins of this people. So this is where they looked for literally everything. This is Paul, in effect, saying, I determine not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. It was that central.
So it seems as if there were very few distractions for those people. This was the center of their life.
It really was. I mean, this is where they went for everything, so that when they would bring their sacrificial animal and symbolically lay the hands on them so that the animal really was an innocent animal dying for their sins, they could begin, I suppose, to have the priest. Now, I don't know if the priests did a lot of preaching, but my guess is that, in fact, they did preach, and that in some sense they told the one who was the penitent, the sacrificiant, they would tell them that this innocent animal is dying because of your sins. And I wonder if they didn't also point to the Messiah who would come and finally fulfill all of what this represented in the Old Testament. So it was obviously very important.
The fact that something was giving up its life as a result of transgression, I mean, sets the pattern for what follows.
It certainly does. It certainly does. And in chapter 25 now, let's jump into that for a moment, where it talks about God is still talking to Moses up on the mount, and he's giving him the instructions for the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant, and he's telling him, we might have mentioned this last time, if I recall correctly, that Moses was to gather from the people the jewelry and the riches that they had, quotes, gotten by spoiling the Egyptians for the purpose of constructing this place of God, this, quotes, house of God. And they were to get a variety of things, gold and silver and brass, and they were to use goat's hair, and they were to weave, by the way, that veil which would separate the two places we'll talk about in a moment, the holy place from the holiest place. They were to use a kind of pure silk or linen for that, which would symbolize purity. And the goat skins and the ram skins and the badger skins, all of these were for the purpose of construction. They all were significant. I take it that the goat skin, which was kind of drab, would illustrate the humility of Christ, and that the ram's redness would illustrate this substitutionary sacrifice, and that the badger skin, which was rough, indicating, like in, Isaiah 53, there is no form nor comeliness, no beauty that we would desire him, that idea. All of these things were significant, so we're not going to pass over them without at least mentioning some of the ideas which have been presented in connection with also the appliances which were used and useful in that tabernacle and in the service.
So it's as if nothing that's being put into this tabernacle is without some significance or meaning that would be teaching some eternal truth to the worshipers.
Yeah, nothing superfluous. This is all meaningful. And I'm sure we don't know all the meanings, but I'm convinced that the priests knew the meanings and that they would explain this, as we sometimes do in our church services. We need to explain the liturgy because people don't know exactly what's going on, but it's not that it's not significant and important.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So in the same sense, they would come and this would be significant for them. Now then, I mentioned last time that there was this sort of fence, I guess we'll call it that, if people won't get the wrong impression. There were boards that were used in the construction of the fence, which was about 150 feet long and I think about 75 feet wide. Now, that's I don't know how to do that in terms of...
Just a little bit bigger than a football field.
Yes, something like that, I guess. No, not 50 feet, 150
feet. Oh, okay. No, it's not as big as a football field.
A little bit, maybe half.
Okay.
Something like that. Anyway, and then, of course, that would enclose the tabernacle and all the important features. And there was one gate in that, and we mentioned the significance of that. Christ, the door, I am the door, and, of course, the gate, by me, if anyone enters in, he shall be saved. And so inside now, there was at first when you would come in, let's say that we're walking from east to west, then the first item which you would come to would be the altar, the burnt offering. Now, you remember last time we were talking about the fact that fire was miraculously provided, that fire came out from the Lord. And When it did, there's an interesting passage in the book of Numbers that the people, when the fire came out and consumed the offering, they just fell down. Of course, said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord is God. There is no other God aside from this one." Now, it's important for us to remember these events and how the people responded to them. You'll recall that when they saw the fire on the mountain as a really the glory of the Lord as a consuming fire, they said, "Everything that He has said, we will do." I mean, they pledged themselves to this, that they would be obedient to this God. Now, the reason for emphasizing it is how quickly they forgot. And that won't be for very long. We'll find out that they are somewhat other than totally obedient and ready to serve this God and to do anything for Him, who they realized was their God and who had pledged Himself to them. Well, anyway, so that's what you would find initially, that altar and the fire came out from the Lord. We had mentioned the last time Nadab and Abihu, you'll recall, and we had said that they offered, quote, strange fire. I'm not real sure what that means, but it suggests that they had taken some other kind of fire than the fire that supposedly was to be taken, maybe off the altar of the perpetual offering. They were perhaps supposed to use that fire. They used some other, quote, strange fire, foreign fire that they were not to have used. And fire came out from the Lord and consumed those two young men. They had simply disobeyed one of the, quote, rules. It was sort of like, I guess, when Uzzah reached out, touched the ark, you remember, and he was smitten dead immediately for touching the ark when David is bringing the ark into Jerusalem. This is something that will occur later on. We'll get to that. But this had been provided miraculously, and the people saw that, and they responded to it with awe and reverence, realizing what this God could do. And then this is where the offerings were made. And then next to that, beyond that, on our trip west in this enclosure was the laver, the brass laver for washing. Now, the priests would wash their hands and feet before ministering to the Lord. Now, you can imagine when they had offered offerings, and that this would be a bloody kind of offering, that when they washed their hands and their feet, this would be bloody water. So I assume with the altar we can say the cross, and here with the laver we could say baptism. And then they would enter into the tabernacle itself.
So the area that you've been describing so far is the outer court, the mm-hmm. outer area that's enclosed, but it's not the specific tabernacle itself.
Yeah, it's not. It's not the central part of the worship, although it's not unimportant. It just is sort of the, we'll just say the commencement of the service. The priests would then go into all of their duties in the tabernacle or tent of the congregation itself. When you walked in then, on the right side, I guess to the north, there would be the table of showbread. Now, there were some implements on the table of showbread. There were two plates, and there were 12 loaves, six on each plate, representing the 12 tribes. And this is sometimes called the bread of the presence, signifying, of course, the Lord's presence among them all the time. And these loaves were replaced every Sabbath. The priests would bake the bread, and on the Sabbath they would replace that bread, and the old bread would then be eaten in the tabernacle by the priests. And you recall this instance also with David when he's fleeing.
That's right, and the priests gave him the showbread.
The showbread. This
in
is
order to help sustain him, yeah.
Didn't work out well for the priest.
No, it didn't, because then, who was it? Was that Absalom who was following behind?
It was a sort of a stranger. His name escapes me at the moment. I should know that. But he was watching this, and then he reported this to, to Saul.
Oh,
he reported this to Saul, yeah. And that was very...
Well, Saul took it out on the priests.
On the priests, all, mm-hmm. except for one who escaped. But, yeah, that was that showbread, the same showbread that the priests normally were to have eaten. But, it's interesting how God takes care of people. In this instance, it was David. The men were hungry, and it was provided for them by God himself, really, here.
And the priests had done the right thing.
It did the right thing, yeah. Of course, by feeding him as he fled from his enemy.
Well, we're going to take a break at the moment right now in our discussion of the tabernacle and the different parts of the building itself and the different pieces of furniture that we'll be looking at in order to ask a question. What's most valuable in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence isn't enough without development and vocation. And what is vocation? You see, we believe God works through our vocations, our callings, our careers and roles we are educated to fulfill in order to meet the needs of our neighbor. The mission statement of Concordia puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ and the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 60 programs offered at Concordia by visiting www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. And you can do that by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and there you can click on the contribute page. And I'd like to ask you to do something special if you do this for us. If you go to that contribute page and decide that you're going to support this service of Christ in Every Word podcast, there is a place on that contribute page for you to leave a message or a note. I'd ask that you do so. Let us know that it's through this podcast that you're now supporting the ministry of the Concordia Bible Institute. We'd appreciate having that piece of information very much as we look at how our podcasts are serving our listeners. Well, in just a moment now, we're going to be back talking about the tabernacle and all of the furnishings thereof. Podcast. And during the break, Dr. Seleska remembered the name of that missing person who observed David receiving the showbread from the priests that got the priests into such difficulty, and it was
Doeg the Edomite.
Yes. Now, there's something for you to keep in mind should you ever find yourself in a Bible trivia contest.
Ah, yes. See, these things are not unimportant.
Not unimportant at all.
Just important spiritually, but they could be materially. So, remember, Doeg the Edomite. All right.
Now, where had we left off?
We're in the tabernacle to the right, and we talked about that table that was there. By the way, these things were all gold-covered, so it was interesting how much gold the Israelites must have received from the Egyptians. They were able to, as a matter of fact, gild, it seems, the tables, the table of incense that we'll come to in a moment, and, of course, obviously the Ark of the Covenant behind the veil. So that was the metal of choice, and I think I mentioned last time that there was no silver. There's no silver mentioned in heaven, at least. Silver was used occasionally here, but in heaven you won't find that word silver attached to anything there. It's, I guess, just too commonplace for heaven. Gold, yes, streets and that, but not silver. Anyway, there are a couple of other implements here on this table. One is a pitcher that would be used for the drink offerings, for instance. Usually wine was the offering, which was sometimes poured out. Sometimes it was a drink offering. There was a spoon there. There was incense also, and that would sometimes be used, sprinkled on a variety of things, on sometimes even on that showbread. The incense also, all of these things had appliances which were used to contain these things as they became useful in the offerings. Now, in front of the veil But it's interesting that in Hebrews it's considered in front of the veil, but actually it's considered behind the veil. That is, in Hebrews it says it was behind the veil. It was located in front, but I guess considered behind. But it's the altar of incense. Burnt.
Well, I guess the front of the veil would be the inside part in the Holy of Holies, wouldn't it?
Well, I guess it must have been considered that because that's how it's described in Hebrews, and you have to wonder why you see it located seemingly outside here, and yet that's how it's described. But that's where the incense, it represents, of course, the prayers, and we in the Vesper service, let my prayer, I think it's Psalm 141, let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. And so the prayers and the smoke from the incense rising upward to the Lord, that was there also. And then to your left or the south on that side of the tabernacle was the candelabrum. There were the seven candlesticks. This is not to be confused, by the way, by the Hanukkah candelabrum, which has nine, but there are 8 days of that Hanukkah celebration. That's something else, the Feast of Dedication. If you recall in the book of John, it was the feast that Jesus was in Jerusalem, and it was the Feast of Dedication. That's a different one entirely.
Oh, so there's nine candles on the Hanukkah candelabra. But for the actual one in the tabernacle, just seven.
Just seven. Now,
which matches Revelation, doesn't it?
It does.
Yes, the seven candles.
Right, the seven candlesticks. Hanukkah candle, by the way, the 8 days, the ninth candle, the center candle, is called a servant candle. It's used to light the other candles. But that represents that time. This is between the Testaments, about 250, 270, somewhere in there, when the temple had to be rededicated because a pig had been sacrificed on the altar, desecrating it. And so period of the Maccabees at that time, it had to be rededicated. And that's the time of Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, it's sometimes also called. And that is close to our Christmas, if you recall. And that one is a little different. So not to be confused with the Hanukkah candle. This one has seven, and seven candlesticks. And there are prescriptions for the construction of that also. That was very meticulous. And in a moment, we'll talk about the people who had been chosen by the Lord, in whom he put his very spirit, filled with his spirit, with knowledge and understanding and wisdom and workmanship, skill in workmanship. So that was a man by the name of Bezaliel. God had chosen this man. Now, where did he learn all this, putting this whole thing together? Well, he was, I suppose, the prime architect of it, and he probably simply supervised everybody else as it was put together. But you could believe that they did a very wonderful job, and I'm convinced that he must have learned this trade, the Lord seeing to that, while he was in Egypt. So these are people who had very great skills, I would think, to sew and to mold and shape the metals. All of that they undoubtedly learned as they were serving the Egyptians, but really they were serving a much higher purpose when they were. They didn't perhaps realize that, as often we do not realize how the Lord is preparing us in a special way. Yeah, but we don't recognize what's happening because it's a chore. But at the time, finally, when we look back at that, we realize he had something much better in store for us. Now, behind the veil, this is the holy place. This is where God dwelt. And it's very significant that I emphasize that. This was the place where God dwelt, and it was separate from man. God would separate himself from man. But there was a time of, quotes, reconciliation, when the high priest, in this case Aaron, would go into the holy place on the Day of Atonement.
And that was the only time.
Only time. The only time he would go into the day, on the Day of Atonement, into the holiest place, or the Holy of Holies, first with the blood, as I mentioned, for himself and his family, and then for the people. and sprinkle it around, and then on the mercy seat. But let's go back there now and check into it, because this would represent God's dwelling with them, which he intended and intensely wanted to do. Now, if you think of God apart from Christ, apart from becoming one of us, it's impossible to comprehend what he's like. He is, if you will, incomprehensible is a good word, I guess. Transcendent is a word which is sometimes used. You just simply can't grasp in his majesty and glory, in his power, what he is like. If you just begin to consider the heavens, and we recently had a creation science workshop here, a remarkable one, in which the design of the universe and all of this was brought forth to show how there could be no other way than someone, it's impossible to use the word intelligent in connection with God, because it goes so far beyond what that word intelligent implies, but nevertheless, who has such a remarkable wisdom, understanding of all things, putting this all together when you consider the stars, when you consider the burning of the stars, the sun, and its exact placement, the moon, all of this. It's just, well, the heavens declare the glory of God is the theme for that thing, and you can realize that God knows himself and knows that we can't possibly begin to comprehend him with the little bit of brain we have. And so he wants to live among us. He loves us enough so that he would want to dwell with us. And the more we know about him is we want to dwell with him. Now, that's not only going to be true here in the tabernacle, but it's going to be true in a very literal sense in the New Testament, where he will, in fact, tabernacle among us in a, quote, skin tent of a human being, so that he can live among us, which is what he really wants to do. And when we get to the end of chapter 29, I'm going to emphasize that again, because he does. He wants them to know that he's with them, the one who had rescued them. And he's the one who has rescued us, and he's the one who has dwelt among us, and he can't be known apart from his revelation of himself. That's what the Bible really is all about, first of all, that God would have to tell us what he's like, or we simply would not be able to comprehend or understand anything about him. And but he's separate. He separates himself, but he does dwell with those people in this sort of special compartment in the tabernacle, the holiest place, or the Holy of Holies. And no one obviously would approach that place except for the high priest on certain occasions, indicating that, of course, that this God could be approached, but only, quotes, with the blood. And there is that idea again. Only with the blood. Apart from the blood, there's no forgiveness at anything else. That's what Hebrews says. Apart from the shedding of blood, there's no more offering for sin. Now, there's the mercy seat. On this Ark of the Covenant, there's the mercy seat. There's a little uncertainty as to whether or not that's simply the top of it, or whether or not the mercy seat was of special construction, or whether the special construction was simply the seat. We're not going to go into that argument, that discussion, but the mercy seat is very important. There were the overshadowing cherubim and the Ark of the Testimony, which was sort of a box. And most of our hearers probably will remember that the rod of Aaron which budded and the Ten Commandments on the tables of stone and the golden pot of manna were the contents of that ark. And then there is that mercy seat. Now, if you will look at verse 22, it's a very important verse in chapter 25, verse 22. God says, "There I will meet with you, and I will commune with you from above the mercy seat, which is between the," I'm going to say, "overshadowing cherubim," which, by the way, those cherubim are looking downward. Remember the hymn, "No angel in the sky could fully bear that sight, but downward bends a wondering eye at mystery so bright," as if they're looking at a very, very bright mystery. Or perhaps we could describe it like this. The idea presented there is like maybe two little boys seeing the circus tent, not knowing what's going on in there, but knowing there's some exciting thing going on, and sort of stooping down and peeking under it, that these angels want to see what this glorious thing is all about. It's such a bright mystery. And we have then the construction like this, the mercy seat, the overshadowing cherubim, and then God says, there I will meet with you, and I will commune with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are on the Ark of Testimony, of all things which I will give you in commandment unto the children of Israel. Now think of that for a moment. God dwelling between the cherubim is a replica, make it after the form which I showed you on the mount, the pattern of another mercy seat. And well, I'm going to use that word now, hilasterion. You know it from the New Testament. And we have that Romans chapter 3, verse 25. It starts out like this, I think verse 23. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. And then, whom God hath set forth, Jesus Christ, whom God hath set forth to be a propitiation, hilasterion, mercy seat, whom God hath set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood, to declare at this time his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of them that believe on Jesus. But mercy seat, hilasterion, Christ is the mercy seat. So now they were to look toward this, quotes, mercy seat for forgiveness, for atonement, for everything else. Where do we look? Well, of course, he's completed everything. He has risen on high, and that's where he is seated. But let me explain this a little further by suggesting, first of all, that this is explained in Numbers chapter 7, verse 89, last verse in Numbers chapter 7, where it says that Moses went into the tabernacle to, you know, he's going to hear the one who dwelt between the cherubim speak to the place where he dwelt between the cherubim on the Ark of Testimony. And there he heard the Lord speak to him. So he went into the tabernacle and he stood in front of that veil and the Lord spoke to him. And, you know, some people don't like the idea of a dictation theory, but all the words which I will give you in commandment unto the children of Israel. Now, did he just dictate those words? I mean, they came out and Moses, I'm sure, put them down. Whether you like the idea or not, but in this instance at least, that seems to be the case. And John is pointing to the computer screen, telling me, we're done.
Well, we've actually gone a little bit over time. But this is so important. I mean, tying Christ in every word, and now we're tying Christ into the very center of the worship practice of ancient Israel as they're there in the desert.
Now we're missing the most important part. I'll have to pick that. You guys better come back.
Well, actually, we're going to have about a two-week break before our next podcast as well. I should let the listening audience be aware of that, too. It'll be another couple of weeks before we get our next podcast, but we've certainly left off at a very significant and important part. Well, you can learn more about the Concordia Bible Institute at our website, www.concordiabible.org. And if you want to support this ministry, you can click on the Contribute page and leave a little note in that message area for us. If you're willing to do so, we certainly appreciate that. And until we have the opportunity to be together again in the book of Exodus, learning more about the tabernacle, God's blessings be yours.